It is my pleasure to introduce our presenters, Mary Brunette and Tim Devitt. Dr. Brunette is an associate professor of psychiatry at Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center. She received her MD from Oregon Health Sciences University and is a board-certified psychiatrist who has been involved with research and clinical care of persons with severe mental illnesses and co-occurring substance use disorders for over 15 years. Dr. Devitt is vice president of clinical operations at Thresholds, a large psychiatric rehabilitation agency in Illinois. He received his doctoral degree in clinical psychology from the Adler School of Professional Psychology and has worked with community mental health programs for over 25 years as an outreach worker, team leader, therapist, program director, research, and executive level administrator. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. And thank you for everyone who's presented so far and the people that will still be going before us. You've given us a lot to think about. And I know for us at the organization, I come from at Thresholds, it's always something we're trying to better understand and see how we can get better. So it's invigorating to hear what else is going on, for sure. I'm happy to be presenting today with Mary Brunette as well. Thresholds and Dartmouth have had a really great partnership for going back to 2009, really working on this quit smoking topic. So today we're gonna share a little bit about what we've been working on in a study that we did in partnership with UIC back a few years ago, and ended about 2 years ago. But I want to start by taking a look at the prevalence of smoking in the population. This chart here shows the rates of lifetime smoking and smoking cessation. It's part of it was generated from the National Comorbidity Study and represents over 4,000 people who were surveyed in the early 90s. And as you can see in this circled area, the data show that there's higher rates of smoking in lower, that's the gray, in lower rates of cessation amongst people that have more severe types of mental illness, including psychosis, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and bipolar disorder, as compared to people with no mental illness, where it's almost the same, about 40% number that have a lifetime rate of smoking and also rate of cessation. And what we know from the prior studies that take a look at why smoking is such a higher, there's people with mental illness are smoking at higher rates, is what we know is that, A, people with mental illness tend to smoke more cigarettes per day. They tend to have higher levels of nicotine dependence. And they also tend to inhale more smoke per puff, which increases the net level of nicotine dependence as well. So those factors alone can account for also the difficulties in cessation. We also know that heart disease and cancer and other medical conditions are very much a part of the lives of people that we serve that have mental illness. You know, that it's been referenced already today that folks are dying 25, 30 years earlier than the rest of the population in the United States. And even when we compare people with mental illness who smoke to people who smoke who don't have a mental illness, they're still dying a good 10 years earlier. Are they at a greater risk of dying from? Heart disease, cardiovascular disease, respiratory illnesses, and cancer. One thing that happens when you work in the field for a good 25 years or so is you get to meet a number of wonderful people who are working on their recovery. And I've got a picture up here of two people. It's not their actual picture, but they represent two people that I had the privilege of working with. Back in 1999, I was part of a new dual disorders treatment program that opened in Rogers Park. And the folks that all moved in had a substance use disorder, a severe mental illness, and were homeless. And these are two people who moved in during that. We were the first people to occupy the apartments that they took in the building, and We had lots of fluctuation in terms of the use, substance use that occurred, especially those first few months, in that lots of people who were coming in from the streets and had homeless status were not quitting the day they moved in. But these were two people who, as far as we know, never used substances from the day they moved in. And as the years went on, they began to connect with family, they took some classes, attended lots of groups, became active in the community at the program. And both of them passed away. They both died right outside the apartment, walking back from 7-Eleven to get a pack of cigarettes. Not the same time, but within over a two-year period. They both just collapsed and had heart attacks right there. And, you know, it's helpful for me to just stop and think about, you know, all the work we did to help them not use substances and help them with their symptoms and all of that. But even though we actually had a quit smoking group on site during the time that they lived there, we weren't really doing a lot to engage people who didn't want to quit. We weren't doing much to engage that group that's in the contemplation stage of treatment. You know, if you look at the stages of change, pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. We had an action stage intervention that maybe 10% of the people would check out from time to time, but most of the people were in that contemplation stage, and that's where these folks were. And I feel bad about that. I do, and I think, you know, there's a lot that there's a lot of factors that go into that, and I think as a field, it's just something that. I can speak from my experience working in mental health. It's in co-occurring substance use. It's something that we haven't really addressed, treating tobacco dependence, especially for people in the earlier stages. And I had a question out here, and I know the format isn't so much we have question and answer afterward, but if people just have some ideas, what are some of the reasons maybe we haven't been addressing it? And I know there may be some groups in here really addressing it now, but just if we look at the overall mental health system, some factors that likely contribute to why we're not addressing or haven't addressed it over the last 20 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Depending on where they were in the recovery journey. And now you're going to take away my smokes and my comfort food. Forget about it. So I think some of it was that, you know, until we could create other ways to get that comfort and get social connection and so on, which our programs try to do, those are some fallback strategies.
Yeah. It's my last, their last personal freedom, you know, last
right,
thing that they have in terms of their, yeah,
I have
to take my substances away, take my other things away. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, helps with symptoms, anxiety, depression. Yeah, some belief about that. And yeah. Yes, sir.
I also think people think that offering a group is good enough.
You're right.
And we don't do a good job in general helping people change behavior.
Yeah, right.
It's not just smoking, it's eating, it's nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's even being engaged in, you know, services.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't do a good job.
Getting people connected.
In general.
Mm-hmm. Why bother? Yeah, it's too difficult. There's. We are doing something. We're offering a group. That's enough. It's too hard for people to quit. Yeah.
The system is crisis oriented anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's the least of our troubles
right now. We've got We have more important things to address, such as a crisis, such as helping people stay alive. And with the immediate acute things that come up every day. Absolutely. And I think those are all exactly what we're seeing too, is that there's as we work with our organization to make change and to really try and address this, there's these are all part of the conversation, you know, that typically can come up. And we see it around different places we go as well. The good news is that people with severe and persistent mental illness do want to quit smoking, and when we stop and look at some of the literature, we can see some evidence that people are interested in quitting. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're successful at quitting. And when we ask, and when we stop and look at what are some of the ways that they're trying to quit, the number one way they're trying to quit is cold turkey. which is they just abruptly stop smoking. But we hope we can change that story, and we hope we can help people to engage more fully in treatment, because there are also examples of treatment working. This study cites a VA study, a naturalistic VA study that offered quit smoking groups, bupropion or NRT to over 400, I want to say it's about 231 people, and they achieved some really good outcomes. They had about 36% of the people that were in their study were able to quit smoking for at least 1 week. But even within the week, and this is those people that had severe and persistent mental illness, the people with depression, bipolar, were at about 40%. And even with the people with schizophrenia were a little lower, but they still had some success at quitting. And I think that's impactful for us to be thinking about, you know, this is possible. There are, you know, we can help 20%, 30% of the people quit over at least for a week period. But it's also something we're seeing. We have to keep trying. We have to keep trying and helping people with multiple quit attempts often. So treatment can work for those who choose to engage in, at least for a percentage of the people. The next question is, how do we engage them? How do we help those folks who are more in that contemplation stage move into preparation, move into action? And, you know, I'm sure we all have some experience and familiarity with motivational interviewing. And there are studies that suggest that motivational interviewing is, in fact, helpful for people who are, in terms of delivering motivational interviewing and engaging people in conversations about their smoking. But we also find that they're not typically offered in a regular way in our care system. And part of that may have to do with all of the other work, especially at the community support level, in terms of trying to help people with housing and trying to help people access health care, trying to help people, you know, just make offering practical assistance to meet their daily needs. It may not come up as much in conversations, but what we're hoping to do, and we're going to talk more about it with this intervention, is that we've been working on is to develop a website that will incorporate some principles of motivational interviewing, offer health education, and also shared decision-making, help people to kind of make decisions about what they want to do as they kind of work through this. It's a website-based application. And one of the things we did earlier, and Mary definitely took the lead on this, is looked at how usable were the current websites that were already out there to help people quit smoking. And I was able to participate in the study that we did. Did a Google search, listed quit smoking treatment. Quit smoking websites in the top four that came up. We identified those, and we brought people in, different sites, and we asked them to look for a couple things. I think one of them was a quit smoking medication, and I forget the other one. It was a treatment. Coping wire quitting. And we asked them to try and find those two topics on the website. And what we found is that people had a lot of difficulty navigating the websites. They tended to be very complicated. They tended to be very stimulating. There was lots of different boxes and columns. And just if a person had never used a computer before, never been on a website, had difficulty with a mouse, and even people who had some experience using the computer still had challenges with that. The one site that had the most... it had the content that was most reliable was showed to be very difficult for the people to use, and that was smokefree.gov. It's a U.S. government website. People had trouble though with that, so it kind of helped the study group kind of in building the website to really consider that to develop a site that first of all that would target and helping people be motivated to quit, provide information on treatment options and referrals, was welcoming to all types of groups of people, all racial groups, ethnic groups, and was based on their area plan behavior, taking a look at what were some of the factors in their own minds and their own attitudes that may contribute to them thinking that quitting smoking is something they can't do. That was internally looked at some of their motives for continuing to smoke, as well as some of the perceived benefits of quitting, and then also honor their role in making decisions about what they wanted to learn and what they wanted to do. So we're going to get to the website in a minute, but it's basically set up taking into consideration some of what we learned from the earlier studies on websites. There's a mouse tutorial to help people understand how to use a mouse. It's a simple linear design. It kind of reads like a book. It's a personal electronic book. Somebody will open up the web page, and they'll have the screen. They'll click on a big button, and it'll go to the next page, and go to the next page. Simple language. It's at about a fifth grade level. And also there's text to audio. So as a person is reading, there's also the words are also, there's a narration. They can turn that off if they choose. So what we have here is the, I'd like to kind of show you the site, give you an idea of what it. Let's see here. So you're going to hear it here in a minute.
Welcome to the Let's Talk About Smoking website. This is the homepage. It contains useful information about smoking. The information comes in three parts. You can move your computer mouse to put the arrow on the boxes below and click to see information that helps you know more about how smoking fits into your life, the good things and the not-so-good things about it. For most people, it works best to go through the information in order, 1 through 3. It will take about an hour to see all of the information on the site. Have fun! 1.
So you can see that, so we have text-to-audio software here, so it will read. There's supposed to be an icon allowing us to turn that off, and I don't know why that's
not
there.
Yeah, it's
not coming up. Then you click on these really big boxes, and were you in this?
Yeah, I was.
All right. So do you want to scroll to the page?
Yeah. First we'll show you... There's a number of choices that people can have as they do it, but that's the introduction. Then what we have is just going to show you a couple things. There's a choice in hosts. Actually, people give their age. People have choices in terms of they want to hear from this gentleman or this woman. They can have choices such as that. Something about John Hamm here.
Cool.
Yeah.
So this is getting at social norms for quitting. We're trying to really help people get a sense that, people do quit. Cool people quit.
If you've seen the show, they're smoking all the time in it, right? So.
My motivation's already up.
Yeah. Let's see, I've got this 15. Where's 15? I wanted to show the likes and the dislikes. In this section, a person will be asked, again, we're trying to get at what they like about smoking, what needs is it meeting in their life. So they're asked to endorse a number of questions. Here's the first one. Smoking helps me when I'm angry or irritable. And then also level of importance, too. So we'll say it's very important. The next one would be, smoking helps me when I'm bored. So at the end, they'll get a summary at the end, and it'll help them to kind of be able to look at all the different things that they said it would help them with. And then there's also a number of questions that get at the dislikes. So these are the motives, perhaps, some of the internal motives for changing. So they'll be asked questions about their health, about the expense, the financial expense, a number of questions related to that. So at the end, they actually kind of get a pros and a cons. List that they can kind of look over, and then they'll be asked later at some point, where they're at in terms of their level of motivation to want to make a change. There's also, let's see, I want to show you too. There's also lots of testimonial in here that people are, There's testimonial, so people will be asked. There's about 13 quit video stories, and there's 13 different pictures of 13 people, and they can choose who they want to hear their quit smoking story from, and they can also choose if they want to hear about counseling, or they want to hear about the patch, or lozenges, or Chantix, or bupropion, the different type of medication, and then as well, there's a section on treatment, and that again, they're asked if they want to learn about counseling. Do they want to learn about NRT? Do they want to learn about Chantix? Do they want to learn about bupropion?
And the number for section 2.
Section 2 is 13. Yeah. So throughout it, they're continually asked, is this something you want to learn more about? Here's the picture of the 13 people they can choose from. Yeah, and we're going to hear one. We're going to hopefully see one of them at the very end. We brought one to, we'll show Yusuf. Yeah. So that's basically it. We just wanted to give you a feel for it. It takes people anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, you know, to get through the entire thing. We've had, an RA present, a research assistant present with people, offering, you know, teaching how to use the mouse if needed, things like that. But for the most part, you know, we've done it with younger adults, but they tend to get through it a lot faster. You know, people who have never used a computer before tends to take longer. But even for the people who are having taking a longer time, there's some self-efficacy that comes with feeling good about learning how to use a computer and having that success. And sometimes that's the feedback. You know, I really feel I learned how to use that mouse. I learned how to use the computer today. So, but in terms of the smoking, it's we're going to share some of the outcomes that we've been getting as well. So, Mary.
Okay. All right. I'm a pacer. Okay. So we developed our program. We did a pilot with Thresholds as a partner. They did a wonderful job of just trying this program out, and this was our pilot data. We found that after using this program, if we followed people for 2 months, almost 45% started cessation treatment, compared to the control group where about 15% started treatment. So we thought that looked promising, and we wanted to do some more work to see whether this thing really worked. And this is where I met Judith, and we were able to get some funding through her center to look at a little bit more about what makes this program work. One of the pieces of this program, well, let's talk about the motivational content of the program. It provides information about the consequences of smoking. Usually people find that motivational. It also does assessment and personalized feedback. Tim showed you part of that, the likes and the dislikes. People calculate how much money they spend on cigarettes. They also get a reading from a carbon monoxide monitor. That is this thing. This is a little device that happens to cost over $1,000. But when you blow into it, it will provide a reading, a number, telling you how much carbon monoxide is in your breath. What is carbon monoxide? It's a poison that is in cigarette smoke, same poison that comes out of your car exhaust system. And when people see the number, they blow in it, it says, oh, 30. What does 30 mean? 30 means there's a lot of poison in your lungs right now from smoking. Whereas if a non-smoker blows in it, it ought to be zero, but if you live in a big city, it might be 2 or 3, or even 4 if it's a bad smog day. But this, people generally like it. This has been a component of all the motivational interventions that have been done with people with SMI around smoking. However, if you look at the general population literature, it hasn't been used much. It's been used a little bit, and the results from using this kind of assessment and feedback is unclear. And the problems we were running into is many clinics don't have these. They don't want to use them. They feel they're not licensed to use them. They don't want to train their staff to use them. So we were running into barriers in using our decision support system with carbon monoxide feedback. So we wanted to know, is it necessary? What else could we do instead? If we had to give up the carbon monoxide monitor, could we use a health checklist with feedback? This has been shown to reduce problem drinking. It's a component of the motivational intervention that had been done in people with SMI. It's easy to incorporate, use, and it's free, which I really like. So we decided that's what we would do. We developed a version of our website that had the health checklist with feedback and carbon monoxide feedback. And then we had another version that had health checklist with feedback only. Both of them had the full three components, dealing with social norms, pros and cons list, quit stories, all that stuff. And we did a small study comparing the two. People came in, we assessed them, we randomly assigned them to one of the two computer programs, which they did within 2 weeks, and we did a two-month follow-up. And then with foundation funding from another foundation, we were able to do a six-month follow-up as well. Our main outcome we were looking for was, did people start evidence-based cessation treatment? We also assessed them for their smoking history, any days of abstinence, their attitudes and beliefs about smoking, their social norms around smoking, their symptoms, and their cognitive abilities. What did we find? Well, the group we enrolled was 135 people. Our team at Thresholds was so amazing. They were able to engage and enroll 142 people, actually, in a year into this study. It was just remarkable. They were fabulous. The study group was about 70% male, middle-aged, 46 was the mean age. The highest grade completed on average was 11 years, half African-American, 15% Latino. They smoked on average 15 cigarettes per day, and 70% had schizophrenia. Symptom levels were generally low. The back score, this is a symptom or a cognition assessment. This group was two standard deviations below the norm. That's what you would expect with a group who has schizophrenia. And that's what they were like. We felt like they were pretty representative of the kind of people who are served at Thresholds. Would you agree with that, Tim? Yeah. So here's what we found. We found that there was no difference between groups. Overall, almost a third started cessation treatment, which we thought was great. We concluded that we didn't need feedback from a carbon monoxide monitor in this kind of multi-component single-session intervention. So that was nice. So what did people do when they engage in treatment? What are we talking about here? You can see about a third talked with a doctor about cessation. About a third met with a cessation specialist, who I think was you, right, Tim, at that time. About 10% started a medication. 10% counseling, 10% meds, and almost 15% did both counseling and meds. So that's what it added up to. Additionally, about a quarter of people tried to quit on their own, quit cold turkey. So over half, when you add it all up, over half of people did some sort of quitting behavior. So we felt like our program did indeed get people motivated to try to change. Now, we wanted to know a little bit more about, does it work for everybody, or are there some groups that it works for and some groups that it doesn't work for? We were concerned about, we just want to make sure we were reaching all the different kinds of people that you would see in a mental health center. For example, does it not work for people with lower cognitive ability? That was a concern I had. Or does it not work for people who have one diagnosis compared to another? So we looked at all of these factors, and what we found was the only thing that predicted whether it worked or not was whether at the end of the program, whether you said you were motivated, you wanted to try to quit. That was the one thing that predicted whether you did indeed try to quit. So regardless of your age, your gender, your race and ethnicity, your diagnosis, your symptom level, you're just as likely to try. Same thing with amount of smoking per day, your reading ability and your cognitive ability. It seemed to work equally regardless of the different levels of these characteristics. So we're very happy about that. We also wanted to know a little bit about how people use the program depending upon their characteristics. We wanted to make sure that it was working. So we used the time spent in the program as a marker of how it's being used. And we looked at the motivational section of the program and the decision support section of the program. And what we found was that people who were older and who had schizophrenia or who had lower cognition spent more time in the program. But as I said before, their outcomes were the same. So we felt that what we saw was happening was people who needed to spend more time were taking more time, and that allowed them to overcome any barriers they had in understanding the material, that they were able to get it and interact with it, but it took them a little bit more time. And again, the one thing that predicted... Oh, this was also interesting. People who were more motivated to quit spent more time in the treatment section learning about treatments. It's kind of interesting. So those were our main outcomes, and we've published two papers, one looking at the main outcome, one looking at the different characteristics and how that predicted use of the program. We also, Kelly Ashbrenner at Dartmouth took the lead on doing a secondary analysis looking at social factors in smoking cessation. We looked first at explicit social influences. Those are observable smoking and quitting behavior of others. Now, this is interesting. Research in the general population shows that quitting is infectious. If you know a person who quit, you're more likely to quit. You can see quitting spreading, you know, spreading through communities, neighborhoods, families. So we wanted to think about that. That's explicit social influences. We also wanted to think about implicit social influences. What is that? That is the more indirect attitudes about social norms. So, well, you know, my father was a smoker. If he tried to quit, he wouldn't use treatment. You know, he wasn't that's not cool. So my family, you know, we're tough. We just pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. So it's that kind of thing. Your sense of what people you know would do or what people you care about would do. Now, we've done a variety of focus groups here at Thresholds with Tim and Kristen Davis and others, and we heard from consumers that peers influenced their smoking, and there was a fair amount of discussion about how peers impeded cessation. We also heard about how peers and family and social support actually could really help with cessation. So it could go either way. We heard about both of those things in focus groups. So Kelly did regression models where she tried to look at whether these implicit and explicit social influences accounted for any of the variation in our main outcome, which was engaging in cessation treatment. She did two sets of models, one focusing on did you start a cessation med, and one focusing on did you do behavioral treatment for cessation. Now, in the models for did you start a medicine, people who are older were more likely to use a medicine. People who were in a later stage of change, so they were more motivated to want to quit, were more likely to use a medicine. And people who said their significant other would use a medicine, they were more likely to use medicine. And then there was this. If you endorsed that other smokers would not want to use a med, you were more likely to use a med. So there was some sort of a distancing yourself from other smokers phenomenon there. In terms of behavioral treatment, again, if you said you were more interested in quitting, you were more likely to use a behavioral treatment. If you believed that behavioral treatment was effective, you were more likely to use it. And finally, this is the number of people you smoked with in the last week. If you were the kind of person who smoked with a lot of buddies, you were more likely to go to behavioral treatment, which at that time at Thresholds was a group. So it seemed like people who were not loners but instead were social smokers, they were more likely to go to that group and attend a group. So we thought that this is like the first data I'm aware of looking at social influences on quitting in people with severe mental illness. And it's interesting, needs replication, but it suggests that, you know, there are ways that we could use this information to help people become interested in cessation treatment, or ways in which we can tailor treatment to work for people with particular characteristics. So, you know, if we know that people hang out with other smokers a lot, you know, a group might be really good for them, might be more appealing. Okay. Then we did our 6-month follow-up. Now, here, I thought this was really interesting. Overall, what we found is most people who started cessation treatment did so within 2 months after using our program. We had a few late bloomers, but not very many. Then we also looked at who became abstinent, right? So we wanted to know, and what were the characteristics of people becoming abstinent? And what we found was that about 30% of people were able to get abstinent for at least a week, which is pretty good. It's not that different from what you see in general population treatment studies. And remember, this is people who at the start of the study, they were not necessarily motivated to quit smoking. We recruited smokers. We said, we just want smokers to come and try this program and see what happens. We'll talk to you in 6 months. And we were specifically not saying you have to want to quit. So our program seemed to help almost a third of people want to quit and actually to quit for at least a week. We used regression models again to look at what were predictors of abstinence in this group, and only two things came out. We looked at all of the what you would expect might be predictors based on previous research in the general population and in this population. We found two things. One, people with a higher level of education were more likely to become abstinent. This is a finding that you see everywhere. People with lower levels of education are just less likely to get abstinent. I don't really understand this yet. I'm trying to read and understand this more right now. The second thing we found, which I think is really important, is, and it was a big finding, odds ratio of 4.6, if you use cessation treatment, you are more likely to get abstinent. Now, none of these factors predicted getting abstinence. Diagnosis? No. Cognitive functioning? No. Symptom level? Nope. An overall measure of social support? Nope. Level of nicotine dependence? No. None of those things predicted whether you got abstinent. It's using treatment. That's where the big money is here. And that's awesome, right? We can provide treatment. That's something we can do. So this is where the money is. With folks with mental illness, we need to help them get motivated to use treatment. And then we need to make sure we provide treatment for them to access. Now, relapse was common, but I'm not going to spend a lot of, I don't think we have time to focus on that a lot today, but just know this is a group for whom we need to get them engaged in treatment and provide good, powerful, full-strength treatment in order to help them get abstinent and remain abstinent. Okay, so I know we're over time here. I just want to share for a few minutes what our next steps are, because this really in my mind was just the beginning of a whole program of trying to figure out how are we going to help this group of people give up tobacco, because this is the main driver of early mortality and a lot of morbidity that really, you know, impedes recovery. It impedes wellness. So one thing we've done is we piloted this. You know, I know we have lots of people here in integrated care programs. We piloted this in an FQHC clinic in my hometown, Concord, New Hampshire. We thought people served in those clinics who don't necessarily have severe mental illness may have some of the same characteristics of being a disadvantaged smoker, and perhaps this program would be useful for them. We found remarkably similar findings in that pilot. 40% of people engaged in treatment, 20% of people became abstinent. We have obtained funding, and we're doing a full-on randomized controlled trial of our decision support system here at Thresholds and in New Jersey to prove that, indeed, it is better than the National Cancer Institute pamphlet for consumers. We've also developed, with some NIDA funding and partnership with Thresholds, we've developed a prototype of the behavioral treatment for cessation. And we decided to develop that because we found that here at Thresholds, when people got enrolled in behavioral treatment, they got started and then they often didn't keep coming. It wasn't convenient, they couldn't make it at that time, or maybe there were other factors that led to them not wanting to come. So we thought, let's see if we can develop a web-based treatment that's usable by this population, so it needs to be set up in a way that can be used by people with cognitive impairments. and let's try it out. Maybe if people can use this at home on a home computer, maybe they'd be more likely to use it. Maybe it could augment an in-person treatment, or perhaps it could be used as a standalone. So we developed a prototype, and we piloted it in just six people with severe mental illness who had a laptop that we set up for them in their homes. And what we found was it was pretty promising. Five out of six really could use it, and one person quit. That's just in 3 weeks of having this program at home. So we felt like it's promising. It needs more study. Joelle Farron has taken the lead on cell phone apps. Judith said 80% of apps don't get used. Well, she is looking at those apps that don't get used. Why is that? She's doing a study right now where she's, she's gone through all the apps available for smoking cessation. There's over 500, and she's randomly selected, she chose what she thinks are the 100 best, and then she randomly selected, 10 out of those, and she's testing them among people with schizophrenia. Can they understand them? Can they use them? Results pending. She also developed what she thinks is a usable app, and she's developed a prototype of that and shown that people can use it, and it looks promising. Finally, the other thing we've done, that these are all technology-related interventions. We have a Center for Technology and Behavioral Health at Dartmouth. When you want to help people with severe mental illness quit, there's got to be a partnership between the person and treatment. And that means also treatment providers, because the medication piece is important. Medication plus counseling equals success. Neither alone is enough. Meds plus counseling. So if you've got meds, you got to have a prescriber. So I've been training a lot of prescribers over the last 5 years. I've trained all the prescribers in the New Hampshire public mental health system, and that's a lot of work. So what I wanted to know was, can I do it by video conference? I use evidence-based techniques in training doctors, and I want to know, can I do that via video conference? Will it be as effective? And what I found was, indeed, it is. If you do this, you can get prescribers. You know, their level of prescribing of NRT was flat. We did a single 45-minute intervention. It goes up, and it goes up just as well for people who got training via video conference as in person. So that's really promising, too. So, Mac cannot collect. All right. So what we wanted to end with is a recovery story. Who are we showing? We're going to show you Yusuf, who volunteered to help. He actually participated in our early pilot of the decision support system, and he quit smoking, and he was willing to help us out by continuing to tell his story, and he's co-led groups with Tim and so on.
He was compensated the first time as an actor here, but it's his real story, and it's also one of the choices in the website. So as people are going through it, they can choose him if they want. But there's a number of other people too you can choose from.
We have 10 recovery stories like this.
Oh, what's going on?
Smoking.
Let me just.
First time smoking when I was 14, 13.
Let's start it again.
My name is Yusuf. I have a mental illness. I'm an ex-smoker. I first started smoking when I was 14, 13, so in that area. My friends in the neighborhood I hang out with, they were smoking and stuff. We weren't smoking, we weren't a part of the improv. You know, smoking, I got something like a rushed high, like, you know, kind of dizzy. And it kind of felt good to me. I thought, you know, every time I light up, it's going to be like that all the time. But as time went on, it faded away. When it faded away, that's when I realized I was addicted. Before I brushed my teeth, put on clothes, I light up a cigarette. Get through eating, I got to have another cigarette. If I walk 4 or 5 blocks, I need another cigarette. I tried to fit about at least 15 times. I stopped for about a day, 2 days, then I started back. I smoked for about another 6 or 7 months, tried again, get the same results, you know. So I gave up. I've been looking at trays and stuff for something to smoke.
Last week we talked about triggers.
First smoking group I went to, we discussed benefit of quitting, different treatment. What worked for me might not work for somebody else. We discussed triggers, and I found out I cut down on caffeine. I'm able to cut down more on smoking. Part of the group, I sat down at the computer. I know my Shantex on that computer. Shantex is a pill that takes twice a day in the morning and one in the evening. I remember taking Shantex by filling it with the rest of my medication on my nightstand where I always reach for it. My first weekend, I didn't know it was no different. Each week go past, I was smoking less and less and less. Take time for the builds up in your system. You put up a steel wall between me and my urge. The urge can't get through me, I can't get through the urge. Some medication, I have side effects. Didn't have no side effects, none whatsoever. Going to my 7 months smoke free, and your life be different. I'm more active, start eating healthier. I sleep better, I smell better. Seem like the whole world smells better. Feel like a king. I love riding my bike. The open air, the fresh air, the speed, you know, it's good exercise, keep my weight down, physical, and working on bikes, riding bikes is a passion to me. That's my heart, you know. I feel different now since I quit, you know, and like people want to be around me, you know. And the money I saved from cigarettes, I put that in the jar. So it was time when it got up to about $30. I had spent $30 a week on cigarettes. I'm proud of myself. To me, I learned the inner such thing I can't. Shantec and the group support you, you know, and coach you along. But they'll be there when you need it. Stick with it, no matter how hard it is. And promise yourself that you can do it. You can do anything you want to do. So Fritz, I did, so can you.
All right. Now, how do I get back to the slides? Great. So, you know, at the point we're at right now, we feel like we need to do a little more work to try to figure out how can we further develop and test better strategies to help people who want to quit, learn how to quit. How do we engage and keep people engaged in cessation treatment in this population? So when Judith said this morning, what are the burning questions you want answers to? Well, I would love your feedback around how can we do that? What are your thoughts about what would work for this population? What do you think will help people who want to quit engage and stay engaged in cessation treatment? And then we can also take any other questions you have.